and then when she got elected, she had to kind of cave and kind of wimped out, quite honestly, on her stance on Palestine. So I will. It'll be interesting to see if Airbnb decides to back down and relent, and then continue to let settlement people get Airbnbs in settlements.
It's still great that they even took the first step. You know, I mean, like, we see artists all over the world that don't take up the invitation to perform in Israel, and like Lana Del Rey, and you know, whoever else. It's still cool to see that, even if it doesn't go through all the way. Like, Airbnb is this massive corporation, and the fact that they even took one step is...
I mean, the amount of success that the BDS movement has had, and it was, like I said, 2005, so we're going on, 13 years?
Mm-hmm.
The success that the BDS movement has had compared to what the... and it is modeled after the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'd like to just let the audience know that the only government that was in solidarity with South Africa and apartheid and on the side of the apartheidists during that time was Israel. Even the United States took a stand against apartheid in South Africa. So you find that the whole relationship with that. So every victory, but the BDS movement has had so many victories comparatively. And you know, that struggle stands on its own, but we also gain a lot of some encouragement from what they were able to accomplish.
Right.
In South Africa, there's also a lot of solidarity from South African comrades to the BDS movement. There's a huge BDS movement in South Africa. In Ireland, like, there's a lot of places around the world where we don't see it in the U.S. media.
Mm-hmm.
Why I referenced that documentary earlier, because I think if people get outside of the U.S. media tunnel, it's like a vacuum, then you can broaden the scope and see just how much solidarity there is for Palestine. Like, the protests and the marches last time there was a massacre in Gaza were just incredible. Hundreds of thousands of people coming out in the streets and saying, "We stand for Palestine. We stand for truth and justice."
Right.
You know, and like you said, many artists are starting to stand on the right side and saying, "I'm not going to perform in Israel." It's not about the individual artist; it's what that stands for when you go to the occupied territories.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's also the other one I wanted to mention is PACB, which is there's also an academic boycott. It's the cultural and academic boycott of Israeli institutions. So it's not so much about, you know, kind of demonizing the individual. It's what that individual is connected to and stands for. And so folks, you know, again, a lot of misinformation, but again, folks should go to the BDSmovement.net to get the best information about what the movement has to say about itself and what it actually stands for.
Okay, well, did you have anything else you wanted to add, Heidi?
I want everyone to get on board with BDS movement. Folks can also look up Students for Justice in Palestine and see the amazing work that's being done. And I would say that any time you can go to an event to learn about Palestine is great. I think learning from Palestinians and their struggle is amazingly inspiring. And the thing is that there is so much solidarity between the Black Lives Matter movement and the indigenous struggle and the Palestinian struggle. And to be able to see that, especially not coming from those cultures, is amazingly inspiring and shows me that that is the right side of history to be on. And so I think if folks can look at that in totality and realize that it's the right thing to stand for Palestine, if you're fully for social justice and freedom and equality for everybody, then you will stand in solidarity with Palestine. And by extension, you know, that means no one is free until everyone is free. And I will end on this. Nelson Mandela said, you know, basically, we're not free until Palestine is free, because he understood what that meant. And so we stand on the shoulders of amazing people who have lost their lives to this struggle, but we continue it. And hopefully lots of folks will learn from this conversation. I think that's pretty much it. Thanks for making the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. Have a good day.
You've been listening to an interview by KABU's Laila Kanaan with Portland activist Heidi Lee, who attended a recent National Conference of Students for Justice in Palestine at UCLA.
The time is 6:03 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. to you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the November 26, 2018 edition of Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Amanda Hill, here with my co-host Jamie Partridge.
Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Jamie. With us in the studio, we have Justin Norton Kirsten, solidarity organizer with Portland's Jobs with Justice, and Michael Purcell, a rank-and-file union carpenter. They're here to discuss the rise of fascist, sexist, and fascist attacks on our communities and the ways labor can fight back. Welcome.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
So, starting out with the big picture, why do you all think we see a rise in white nationalists, misogynist, and fascist activity in the U.S., well, and the world today? Either one of you want to bite off on that? Why do you think we see a rise here?
Sure. I mean, really, I think it comes down to a growth of income inequality. Growth of income inequality and growth of affordability of living. It's something that we see as a huge problem now. It's something that was a big problem in pre-World War II, you know, Germany and Italy, where we saw the first real kind of big rise of fascism and those kind of dangerous nationalist movements. And I think here in the U.S., that really coupled with the lack of a strong and coherent, really working class rooted left analysis and response to the social and political problems that we've been experiencing over the last half a century.
I'd have to agree with that. I'd say that when the Democratic primaries were basically derailed, a lot of people who were in the middle, the 60%, you know, they like to use the 60-40 perspective, where it's like, okay, there's 20% on one side, 20% on the other side, 60% in the middle. That 60%, many of them that were for social progress, they got reactionary. They got reactionary quick, and I think this income inequality, it's like gasoline on that fire.
Absolutely. So how does the rise of the white nationalist movement, with Trump as its agitator, of course, open up our unions to the influence of racist, sexist, and fascists? Workers are losing ground, and fascists often offer a fight against the establishment. Do you feel that's happening in your unions?
I would say that this kind of plays into that the prior question, where, you know, there's been this thing called the men's rights movement, and the men's rights movement, mm-hmm. effectively, you know, in Europe they call these groups rape gangs because that's what they are. You know, they pressure women into compromising positions, and they extort them into abuse, and they lie about it. They gaslight. And now what we have is these alt-right activists, and that's what they do. They joke about racism. They joke about oppression, and that's their shtick. And they're active in our unions. I mean, we see, you know, in my union, there's a couple different groups up in Washington that are actually, they have active members. They're terrorist groups, and they've got active members in my union, and trying to pressure them to take that support off their pages. It's bad.
Yeah. Justin?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, ultimately, unions in the past have been racist and, you know, white only and male only, certainly have had sort of rabidly nationalistic and xenophobic periods. And, you know, it took years of concerted organizing to bring labor in the U.S. to a place where generally we're not scapegoating immigrants, for example, when it comes to jobs and unemployment. But to some extent, that does still happen. We still see these sort of nationalist frameworks, particularly when it comes to jobs being outsourced, the sort of Buy American and Pro American and Save American jobs. And so I think it's a slippery slope, and the slope is already there. And so this sort of growth in kind of overtly nationalist and racist and white supremacist rhetoric and sort of attitudes just puts us really in danger of slipping back down that slope and sort of moving back to a time when unions were a little bit more fascist in reality.
To me, it seems like it puts us in a delicate position, given that we fight for those good economic deals in our contracts, and it kind of puts us with that class that is the ruling class in a certain manner. And how do we deal with that in our you know, in our dealings with our members themselves and with the public.
That's a good point. I mean, I think that comes down to things like bargaining for the common good, right? Like, we have to organize beyond just our unions and care more about the work that we do benefiting just the members of our unions, right? And really extending our work to benefit society and our locality, whatever that looks like, you know, to benefit more than just the members of our particular union.
So how do you think our labor movement has allowed itself to be undercut by the far right? Mike, do you want to talk about that?
I would say that, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, you had the CIO and the Carpenters Union in particular. We were active in organizing lumber mills down in the South. And, you know, we had the KKK bombing our union meetings. There's a reason we have wardens posted at the door. There's a reason many of our constitutions, you know, call for us to have passwords to enter our union meetings. And, you know, we lost sight of this. We lost sight of this, you know, common message. You know, at the start of our union, you know, our magazine was printed in 6 different languages. You know, our constitution said we were opposed to discrimination in any form against women, against, you know, people of different ethnicities or creeds. You know, and I think that you were right to point out the class alignment issue, because ultimately, you know, people at the top, they profit by dividing people, by allowing people to be divided, but also by promoting divisions. And we see that plenty of that with the Koch brothers.
Yeah. Do you want to bring us to the local?
So recently, Mayor Wheeler tried to get an ordinance passed that would have prohibited gatherings against, like, fascism when the Proud Boys show up in town. It would also have had an effect possibly on the way that unions could hold rallies against their employer for better contracts, et cetera. Did you feel that that would have been the case?
Well, absolutely. I think that that was the most harebrained thing that, you know, Portland Business Alliance has come up since the sit-lie ordinance, quite frankly. I mean, their response to right-wing people running over protesters in the streets, left-wing protesters, is to criminalize dissent and to try to put Portland behind a fence. Well, I got news for that guy. We don't fit in a pen. You know, and if they're going to try to take the combined strength of the American labor movement and put us in a pen, good luck.
Yeah, I hope. Yeah, seriously. Yeah, I mean, my main concern is really that it's going to be disproportionately used against the left, whether that's labor unions specifically or sort of the broader left. I mean, we've seen it already, you know, kind of time and again. The mayor will, you know, give free bus rides on public transportation to fascists after their rally, and then, you know, next week they'll turn around and they'll, you know, shoot at leftist protesters with tear gas and
snipers on the roof.
Right, yeah. And I mean, imagine what would happen if some people who were blocked up, you know, Antifa type people or you know, Black Bloc people on top of a roof with you know, assault rifles. I highly doubt that they would have gotten to walk away the way that,
or got their guns back.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
So yeah, I mean, I think it's great that it got knocked down, because we know that they're going to use it against us, and that it's not going to benefit sort of peace and anything good in this town.
So the ordinance would have mandated that organizations that are known to be violent in the street, have a history of violence in the streets, would have to have specific restrictions on where they could protest. And it went down, but then what happened a week ago when the hashtag #HimToo Proud Boys held their protest and the Pop Mob and others showed up to counter-protest? What happened?
Well, the police locked down the park itself and put themselves in a cage.
That one, it was good. Yeah, I mean, they basically just did it anyway. It was like, We don't have permission to decide when and where you can protest, but we're going to, you know, cordon off whole parks anyway and decide when and where you can protest.
It was a relatively peaceful event. You know, I saw Proud Boys trying to throw signs at people. I saw people trying to throw water bottles back, you know, but it was on the curbs. You know, I was surprised that the police didn't try to escalate things. But at first, you know, then I started to hear the, orders coming over the cops' radios saying, you know, be peaceful, don't escalate this. And, you know, when you hear stuff like that over the comm channels, it communicates that the mayor understands the position. I mean, he doesn't want a political crisis on his hands, and that's what he was handed by his inability to address the Portland Police Force's activity in the streets. Because ultimately, when you act in a political way to favor one side over another, there's political consequences. And we see that today in Portland politics.
Absolutely.
But that clearly happened in the streets on that Saturday when people gathered on the sidewalk across the street from the Proud Boys, and the police shut down the street and the sidewalk and arrested people who didn't scramble off the sidewalk. Am I right?
I wasn't there.
Oh, okay.
No, that is right. It was interesting too, because I mean I've seen the police shut down sidewalks before, but never in conditions like that, where it's relatively small groups of people and things are relatively calm. It's always like the police are already attacking people, or there's already some kind of scuffling there's already a situation where the police feel like they need to really shut things down, as opposed to, you know, people just kind of hanging out and yelling at each other, or even like, you know, lobbing a bottle or a sign across the street. Like, it's always at like the sort of bigger mass mobilizations. Like, I mean, probably, I don't know, maybe even as far back as Occupy, the kind of last time I really saw that.
Well, personally. The last time I saw them really try to shut down the protest was the incident where the Proud Boys wrist rocketed a M80 over the police into the protest, and the police responded by leveling a flashbang at someone and shooting them directly with a flashbang. I was there when they stampeded the local media. I was doing media defense with the local organization that we were talking about earlier.
That was August 4th.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And I think what Jamie was trying to get at is that even though the ordinance went down, the mayor decided that he was going to try and enact it anyway in his own way. So what can we do when we're faced against him kind of going rogue anyway?
It's going to take mass mobilization. It's going to take increasing the class consciousness. It's going to take preparing for the crises that are coming down the road. You know, we can't continue to focus on, you know, the challenge that we faced. We need to be thinking about the challenges ahead, and we need to be inoculating our members, educating our members for those challenges, because otherwise we're going to be kind of caught in the lurch when it gets much, much worse, which it will.
So if you've just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. We're talking with Justin Norton Kurtzen of Portland Jobs with Justice and Michael Brussell, a union carpenter, about the rise of fascism and the response of our labor movement. So speaking of the response of our labor movement, Michael, can you tell us a little bit about the carpenters have taken a particularly strong stand against racism and fascism. Tell us what that is and how that happened.
Well, I would say a couple years ago we passed a motion in our local to formally brand the top like 20 different hate groups as enemies of our union. Where this came out of is the recognition that you couldn't really hold to account members who took violent, even terrorist acts outside of the union for the consequences of their behavior and how it reflects on us as an organization. We had a member, so I was organizing for affordable housing, trying to pass an incentive program, and it came to my attention that a member, a attempted to blow up some homeless people. That hit the brakes on that organizing and shifted, you know, caused me to shift gears into trying to figure out what accountability would look like inside my union. And as I began to have that conversation with others, it became readily apparent that this wasn't a problem that was just in my union. It was a problem in many unions. And that's when we began to look at, as a movement and as an anti-racist movement, passing motions that we could share among various cadres, which would be teams, you know, that work on this kind of stuff, and more generally the broader anti-racist left and labor unions.
And so you passed a resolution that specifically called on your union to do what?
To oppose these organizations, to oppose these hate groups as enemies of our unions that have historically opposed our interests as unions, and, you know, to do whatever it means to really stop them. And this has resulted in not just our local, but I want to say five other locals passing this resolution, as well as our regional council, which I don't speak for, you know, any of them, but we do, you know, we do get out there and, you know, just let them know that they can't attack the labor movement. And, you know, there have been instances where people have, you know, been hurt defending the labor movement, you know, but really at the end of the day, if you let anti-union forces gain traction, if they cause people to fear to go to the ballot box, then ultimately they have power over the political process. And when you look at what's going on across the country, people are being intimidated away from the electoral process by right-wing terrorists that are doing everything from attacking polling stations to hanging out front with dogs or guns or bombs, or I mean, it's, that's where these guys are going, and we can't let them win.
Justin, yeah. I know that Jobs with Justice endorsed a similar resolution around the same time that they endorsed theirs. Can you speak to that?
I don't remember that resolution.
Well, it was actually, it may have been before your time on the board.
Maybe.
We took the same resolution that you guys passed and brought it to the board and endorsed it. As something that Jobs with Justice stood behind as well. I know that you are the solidarity organizer for Jobs with Justice currently, and a lot of your work is with the labor movement, but also with community organizations. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to how Jobs with Justice is helping to fight racism and fascism in the city?
Yeah, I can't believe I don't remember that resolution. I mean, so yeah, I think we've been doing quite a bit. I mean, I guess going back a couple years after the election in 2016 and when we really saw the uptick in at least in reported hate crimes here in Oregon, let alone non-reported hate crimes. But we organized a rally and march for a united front against Trump agenda that sort of brought people from a lot of different labor organizations, unions here, and community groups here in Portland. The day after the inauguration, actually, it sort of fed into the Women's March. That was in some sense sort of a launching pad for the Portland Stands United Against Hate that ended up developing coalition to sort of specifically react to what Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys were doing. And that sort of now has sort of been replaced by Pop Mob and other groups that are sort of doing similar functions and doing similar organizing. So I think that was a big piece of it. And then we formed what we call the Solidarity Squad, which has sort of broadened its scope a little bit since then, but it was sort of originally designed as sort of a way to train people specifically in de-escalation tactics and direct action tactics so that we could sort of pull together safety teams or whatever type of quote-unquote security-type support at events that different organizations around town, particularly organizations that are led by marginalized populations. We felt it was important for there to be groups out there that could provide assistance so that people, whoever they are and whatever their issues or their background are, that can feel safe organizing in public and feel that there are people there to look out for them and to be there with them and fight with them if needed to be.
So let me ask a and kind of large picture question that both of you can jump in on. So what do you think the larger labor movement should be doing in response, looking forward, to the mobilizing and the harassing and the recruiting that's being done by the Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys, and other sexist, racist, and fascist groups in this area? And you can talk about what you think is coming down the road as well.
I would say that, first off, I just want to give a short plug to a couple of comrade groups, you know, Class Struggle Workers Portland. You know, y'all do great work in getting folks mobilized out there. And I'm also going to say, you know, Portland Anti-Fascist Workers Collective, you guys are really on point in terms of your research and just kicking fash. Good job. I would say, you know, coming down the road, we're looking at a lot of people being displaced from coastal areas by climate change. We're looking at a lot of people being pushed into rural communities without a lot of resources, infrastructure, jobs, good paying jobs. You know, this divide between, you know, people having all the money and everyone else not is a real problem. And it's going to get worse as we're pushed off the coast and into the rural communities. And what you're going to see is you're going to see these people exploit this. You know, they're exploiting the immigrant crisis in Europe, and they're going to exploit the immigrant crisis in America. And that's going to get manyfold worse. I mean, when you look at the fire that's going on the West Coast, climate scientists say that's going to get up to 7 times worse in the next 10 years. Can you imagine what that's going to do to populations moving into rural communities, into red states? The FBI, you know, the Pentagon basically released a paper that basically says, more or less, that our country will be lucky to survive the next 20 years of climate destabilization. Now, as a labor movement, we're the last vestige of democracy that has the capacity to really address this, and we need to be looking at disaster relief in these rural communities so that we have our foot in the door to have those conversations about economic development, about building resilient cities, and the moral credibility to fight fascism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of big picture look at it is right on. To bring it back to labor a little bit, I suppose. I mean, the response really is kind of twofold, and as kind of a good summary, I think, of some of the things that we've talked about. I mean, one, you know, being defensive and really doing the relationship building and the coalition building that's needed to do like real mass mobilizations, like this, the size of which we haven't really seen here in Portland yet.
Amen.
To combat them, fascists and white nationalists, when they come out into our streets. And then on the offensive side, really sort of making labor organizing about the whole community instead of just about our particular union members, and really getting into the bargaining for the common good, and making sure that whether it's at the bargaining table or on the picket line, the things that our unions are doing are going to benefit our whole community and really lift everybody up, so that we're providing an alternative to sort of the fascist ideology in these really kind of trying times.
I think that what you're speaking to, both of you, the mass mobilization it's going to take to get this under control and move forward as a united front against fascism, because if we just fight for ourselves, we're never going to win the fight.
Exactly. Right?
Is there anything that we have a couple minutes before we're done? Is it any last words that each of you would like to share with our listeners about labor and the fight against the rise of fascism?
There is hope. You are not alone. You are not alone. You are going to feel overwhelmed in the times ahead, and just remember that you are not alone, that together we are stronger than they are.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think to sort of piggyback off of that, that I think people really need to get involved, you know, to join an organization, really. I mean, we're not going to fight this back by being sort of, you know, lone wolves, so to speak. I mean, that kind of has a negative connotation, but we're not going to do it by ourselves. We need to find other people, and we need to organize together, or else we're just going to be drifting in a sea that drowns us.
Final words, Amanda?
Well, I agree with you both, and I've seen it in my local union as well. If we tend to think of ourselves just as our profession, as opposed to thinking of us as members of the community, and so it's been my work at my union to get folks to understand that we are the community. We have to take a look at the larger community and fight for everyone, not just for our wages and our benefits.
Thank you, Amanda. That wraps it up for this edition of Labor Radio, this Monday night and every Monday night from 6 to 6:30. I'm Jamie Partridge with my co-host Amanda Hill. We're here with Michael Brissell of the Carpenters and Justin Norton Kurtzen of Portland Jobs with Justice. Want to thank our engineer, Mike, and stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Clinton Street Resistance Series at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Monday, November 26th at 7 p.m. will be Conan the Barbarian, playing as a benefit for Girls Build. Conan the Barbarian is a fantasy story of the sword and sorcery hero. As the sole survivor of the childhood massacre, Conan is released from slavery and taught the ancient arts of fighting. Conan then fights, rescues, and entertains for the next 2 hours. Again, that's Conan the Barbarian playing Monday, November 26th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Before My Time Has Come music video premiere on Saturday, December 1st at 7:30 p.m. at Fifth Avenue Cinema in Portland. The song Before My Time Has Come was written 3 days after Parkland